back again to her bottom and lifting each side as she spanked the lower curve right where her bottom met her thigh. Blanche shook with her sobs. She had never been any more helpless with anyone, any more faint and weightless and without will. Her sex was wet and pulsing with desire, and her breasts were filled with tingling warmth, as if it were moving up from her loins all through her, like a hot fluid more certainly part of her than her own blood. Suddenly the queen pulled her up by her shoulders and slammed her down on her knees. She took Blanche's wrists in both hands and forced Blanche around to kneel right in front of her. "Look into my eyes," she said. Slowly Blanche looked up as if into a blinding light. "Your Majesty," she whispered imploringly. Her breasts throbbed, and her sex was swelling as if it were something that could burst. The fluids ran down her inner thighs. "Lift her up, Alexei," said the queen. Blanche was wrenched to her feet. "Now, present your hips to me," said the queen. "That's it. Thrust them towards me." Blanche struggled to obey, careful to keep her legs apart. Always one was expected to keep one's legs apart. Her calves were trembling as she stood on the balls of her feet, and her thighs and bottom throbbed with pain, a delicious, hot, pulsing pain that was worse now than when she was being spanked. The queen was examining her sex, seeing the flood of moisture, the wetness, as that dreadful Galen always called it. And she felt the queen's thumbs suddenly inside her vagina. Blanche gasped. She could not hold back. She would die before she let the pleasure crest, die before she disappointed the queen and her beloved Tristan, but she couldn't hold back. The orgasm broke loose, and she felt her empty vagina gaping hungrily and desperately as the pleasure flooded up through her and the blood throbbed in her face. They knew it. They saw it. They could not conceivably think it was anything but her spending and spending. And her choking sobs became low hoarse cries. "Take her," said the queen. Prince Alexei turned her. "On the bed." She was forced across the room and then down on the jeweled red coverlet. 1,000 prickly jewels or bits of gold bit into her sore flesh. Prince Alexei pushed her up on the bed and mounted her, without removing his clothes, only lifting his tunic to reveal his organ hard and ready. And then it plunged into her, into the hopeless, aching emptiness. And she felt herself flooded with relief, riding yet another magnificent wave, spending yet again. Her mouth was open and the cries were ripped out of her.
"Hush, little one," he said. "Hush."
His lips covered hers, and he took her cries into himself as he drove his cock harder and harder into her. Unable to stop herself, she wrapped her naked legs around him and rode up off the coverlet with him, only to be wondrously slammed down once more. She wanted to cry. Yes, and yes, and maybe she did. She didn't know. He sucked the breath out of her, his dark hair hanging down onto her face. Finally, he came, and she came again with him. And they shuddered together until it was finally over. And she felt him rising, felt his soft, wondrous weight taken away from her. And for a moment she felt cold, not because the room was cold, but because it was quiet and he was gone. When she opened her eyes, she saw the queen standing at the window by the fireplace looking out into the night. "Oh, my queen," Blanche cried, unable to restrain herself. And without thinking, she rushed off the bed and fell on her knees at the queen's side. "I did so want to please you. Truly, I did. Oh, please forgive me if I've displeased you."
Quiet, Blanche, quiet, said Alexei in a crooning voice as he approached. She felt his hands on her shoulders, gentle but firm. Your Majesty, no one has ever been able to teach this little girl to restrain herself in her outbursts of devotion. The Queen turned and looked down. The light of the fire was behind her, so her face was dark, and the light played in her golden hair. Blanche sobbed in defeat, her hands not behind her neck as they should have been, but covering her face. You did please me, darling, said the Queen in the warmest, sweetest voice. Blanche felt the Queen's fingers gently moving her own hands away from her face. And now her face was lifted, and she knew that the shadowy figure was smiling at her, though she could hardly see the features of her face. You have pleased me very much, precious Blanche, she said. I shall always love you especially for this night. Now stand and come into my arms. Blanche could not quite believe this was happening because her heart was filled with happiness such as she had seldom known. For Tristan to embrace her in this manner gave her the greatest pleasure. But this was the Queen, the new Queen. She embraced the Queen as tightly as she could, holding back nothing, covering the Queen's face in kisses as the Queen kissed her, her breasts pressing against the Queen's breasts, her pubis pressing against the Queen's skirts. The Queen's hands cupped Blanche's head, then moved to her shoulders and her breasts, twisting her nipples, and the kisses became ever more ardent, ever more desperate. The Queen was moaning. Blanche felt the Queen's hand on her hand, pressing Blanche's fingers between her legs, though the heavy fabric of the Queen's skirts protected her. Suddenly, madly, Blanche lifted the Queen's skirts and fell on her knees, kissing the Queen's wet pubic lips, dipping her tongue into the Queen's hot, salty vagina. She could hear the Queen sighing. Blanche clutched at the Queen's naked bottom and worked her with all her might, her tongue plunging ever deeper until the Queen came with loud, sweet moans that caused the floodgates in Blanche to break again as she pressed against the Queen's legs. Drowsily, contentedly, ready for whatever punishment she deserved for her boldness, Blanche felt herself being gently pushed away, petted, caressed, yet pushed away, and she sank down at the Queen's feet. It seemed a long time passed. She crouched with her eyes shut tight, waiting. You will get better at it, said Prince Alexei to the Queen. You will get better at everything.
I know, said the Queen under her breath. But if only I could understand.
All will be revealed in time, said Alexei with even greater gentleness. You've only just begun. Blanche felt the Queen's hands on her head.
Come, dearest, come into my arms again, said the Queen.
Blanche rose at once and held the Queen as tightly as she dared.
Oh, sweet, sweet beyond any caresses she'd ever enjoyed, ever known. This, sweet and intoxicating.
Oh, don't worry, Blanche, said the Queen in her ear.
Don't bother with our words. I am new to taking command in this way, in this secret and erotic way.
The Queen's thumbs fondled Blanche's cheeks.
I do so love you, darling. You have been the best of teachers. Now kiss me again with all your heart.
Part 2. Welcome to Beauty's Kingdom. Chapter 8. Prince Dmitri. The new kingdom at last.
1. A full 9 months had passed since King Laurent and Queen Beauty had been crowned at Bellewalton, and all the world, it seemed, knew of their proclamations. How many eager princes, princesses, lords and ladies, and eager would-be slaves had journeyed to Bellewalton, from all over the European lands, and from the lands to the south, and from those to the east, and from those to the north, and from the Hungarian lands and the Russian lands, and from the lands of exotic climes, part history and part legend. Those seeking slaves in my own kingdom had met with many high-born applicants, and those proud and beautiful peasants who had dreams of being accepted. One day, wrapped in a hooded cloak, I had stood about in the shadows and watched the eager neophytes as they hovered outside the inn, where the emissaries of Bellewalton were receiving, wondering what fair hair and forms were concealed by the heavy garments that so well concealed face and rank. Beauty's kingdom, that is how they referred commonly to Bellewalton. Beauty's kingdom, and the legend of the sleeping beauty and her new realm was the talk of the land. I would have left that very day for Beauty's kingdom, had it been possible. But perhaps the many tasks that had delayed me had been a blessing. For as I reached Bellewalton now, riding ahead of the small caravan of wagons and mounted servants that had accompanied me, I realized that Laurent and Beauty, my old and beloved friends, had made great progress in reviving the kingdom, and I would see it, not in its early days of resurrection and inevitable confusion, but now in full bloom, so to speak, as every innkeeper I'd encountered in the last fortnight had told me. Whatever the case, I'd had little choice but to delay my return. My older brother, the king now for some 20 years, was not eager to see me pursue my dreams, but he had finally accepted it, murmuring that he'd always been against my being sent to Bellewalton in the first place. He'd served in Bellewalton long before me, it was true, but only for a year, whereas I had been there many years, when one included my time in the Sultanate. Yes, it had been a strange and ecstatic pleasure, all that, he said, and much the fashion in those days. Yet why did I wish to go back? I couldn't explain. He had tasks for me to complete before I was allowed to depart. Visits to make, bequests to bestow, cousins to be received, and attendance at conferences that went on forever. And I set out to satisfy him without argument, which had always been my way. You might say I'd learned patience during my time as a naked slave, but in truth, I was patient before I ever knew what it meant to be the pampered plaything of alluring ladies and lords. I was not, by nature, controlled or disciplined, no. That I had learned over time. Finally, my brother had given me his blessing, endowed me with abundant gifts and gold, and after a final week of weepy and riotous banqueting and endless farewells, I'd at last set out, confident that I might come back home if I didn't find the new realm to my liking. Of course, I brought my trusted servant, Fabian, with me, the only being in this world who had ever been allowed to see me naked since I'd left the far-off realm of my old friend Lexius, former steward to the Sultan and slave to Her Late Majesty Queen Eleanor. There wasn't a chance that I wouldn't find the new realm to my liking. 2 long letters from King Laurent had come to me within the first month of the kingdom's rebirth, filled with amazing warmth and friendly words, just as if he were speaking to me, though no doubt some scribe had been taking his dictation, and I could almost hear and see my old friend, whom I had known so briefly but with such pleasure. These letters had been brimming with his enthusiasm for all the new innovations and expansion of the old kingdom, and they had set my blood to simmering at once. And I had received a letter as well from my beloved Prince Alexei, whose brother's kingdom bordered on our own, and he, too, had said only momentous things about Bellewalton, where he now resided. He had also confided that, very likely, Lexius would be returning. Lexius, whom I knew and loved above all others from the time of my service. To think that I might see Lexius again was quite an inducement. But even if Lexius never did make the journey from his far-off home in India, I was bound to return to Bellewalton as soon as I heard of the new regime. That Princesses Rosalind and Elena had also written to me was an added inducement. They had served with me for years in the Sultanate, and they too had returned to Belavaltan. In sum, I could not have turned away from all this. It was a long and arduous journey, but of course the closer we came to the fabled kingdom, the warmer and sweeter the weather, until we were in the blessed land itself. My last night at the nearby inn was torment, but I took the time to bathe and be shaved, and to put on fresh garments for the morning ride to the kingdom's gates. In fact, I spent a long time with my mirror as I reflected on what might soon occur. I'd been looking all too much in the mirror since news of the new kingdom had come. When you are a naked pleasure slave, it seems to me, you learn not to be vain, but to reside completely in your physical being. You become aware of your gifts in a way that is lasting, and perhaps never quite understandable to those who have never been pleasure slaves. You hear yourself described, spoken about unendingly by your masters and mistresses and grooms. You learn what they notice, what interests them, what they value, what they like and don't like, and what ought to be enhanced. Thick jet black hair, rather pale blue eyes, a somewhat delicately modeled face, indeed a bit of a long face, and a large frame. These were my endowments in brief, and of course a cock that was easily as big as most others when standing at attention or in repose. But for the kingdom and the sultanate, these features were never the sum total of any slave's individual charm. The spirit of the slave was paramount. The slave's grace or polish, the timbre of the slave's voice and softest moan, and above all, the expression on a slave's face. I'd been known for hopeless spontaneity, openness, the inability to conceal my feelings or fears, and praised unendingly for appealing eyes. I couldn't forget all this when I heard of the revival of Belavaltan. It mattered to me to be accepted in Belavaltan, not merely for sentiment's sake, or because I'd once been a slave there, but as a self-possessed and impressive courtier now. So I had to make a careful and somewhat ruthless assessment of myself before this journey. Was I youthful still, in any regard? Was I in my prime? Were there more tiny and delicate lines around my eyes than I cared to see in the glass? And it was useless, of course, to ask my mistress what she thought, as she would lie to me out of tenderness, and pointless to ask Fabian, as he adored me and was so blind to his own charms. He lacked a vocabulary for assessing beauty. Whatever Fabian gave me daily, he gave through the devotion in his face and doting voice. Well, on the last night, I made the ruthless assessment once more. My hair was thick as ever and now down to my shoulders, lustrous, still very black, and that was good. Maybe I had kept some of my youthful beauty, even if I had grown very tall during my time in the Sultanate, and if anything, I was fuller of chest now, and better muscled than in those early years. Whatever. Time would reveal the truth that I couldn't find for certain in any mirror. I wasn't turning back. I felt comfortable on the final morning. I wore my best dark puce-colored tunic and trousers, though it was far too warm for them now, and my heavy Russian boots. From a mile away, as we came out of the mountain pass, I saw the great castle on its cliff above the valley, and marveled, as I had that very first time so long ago, at its immense size. It appeared to have a multitude of towers, and from its many crowded pinnacles and ramparts, there streamed red and gold banners furling in the wind. Before the walls and on either side of the great drawbridge, I saw gaily colored tents, and crowds of people about them, and there was an air of energy and business about the entire multitude, milling as far as I could see. The road had been crowded, yes, but I was still surprised at the number of those congregating here. There were campgrounds and other tents off to the right and left, near the heavy, brooding thickets of oaks. Fabian drew up beside me on his chestnut mare, anticipating my questions, and all I had to do was gesture for him to explain. "So many are coming, applying as slaves, or grooms, or simply immigrants eager to live in the kingdom, that the halls inside the walls can no longer contain them," he explained. Of course, he would know, because while I'd rested at the various inns along the way, brooding, dreaming, looking in the mirror, and staring out the windows, he'd been gossiping in the kitchens and with the men in the yard. Fabian was very excited about this venture. I had taken him with me to India when I'd gone there with Lexius, and he had been devoted to me since that time. Brown-haired, big-boned, with cold dark eyes and an amazing warm voice, he always looked splendid in his velvet livery, and went on to explain excitedly what he'd heard along the road. Many are being turned away for obvious reasons, but an amazing number are accepted, he went on. Look there, that line. That's probably all slave postulants. You can tell even from here. Look, the guards are motioning some on and sending others away. Of course, those of royal or noble birth go through the gates. If the guards spot a postulant of exceptional quality, well, they spirit that one right inside. Indeed, I could see this happening to two lovely young peasant women as we watched, and one very comely boy. But the majority were headed to the tents to be interviewed, it seemed, or tested in some way, and there were soldiers lounging about everywhere, to keep order, I suppose, though no one seemed to be breaking the peace. Wine and hot food were for sale from open stands here and there, and I saw a young girl, a very pretty young girl, seated on a bundle, weeping with her hands to her face. We moved on steadily to the drawbridge, and the soldiers greeted us with the predictable respect. Fabian rattled off my many names and titles with appropriate dignity, and we were motioned to proceed through the courtyard gates. Two messengers ran ahead to announce us, I presumed, and I felt my heart going wild inside me as I strove to look cool and collected, my eyes moving over the tops of the walls. There was an air of cleanliness and order everywhere that I looked, and as we entered the first of the great courtyards, before the doors of the castle proper, I saw on either side of us, at a great distance, the immense newly erected halls for arriving slaves and grooms. Applicants were giving up their mounts, their beasts of burden, and laying down their bundles and being escorted inside. There was so much easy and convivial commotion, I couldn't make much of it. But I wondered at the tender feelings of these brave individuals who were hoping so desperately to be taken into Bellavolton's magnificent and engulfing world. Liveried servants, in blue and gold, now poured through the yawning mouth of the inner courtyard to help out the members of our little caravan, and Fabian was on his feet to help me down from my mount. I walked across the broad planks of the gaping passageway as if I hadn't a care in the world, and then there rose before me that vision of the great north facade of the castle with its endless arched windows rising higher and higher to the battlements far above. I recalled, whether I wanted to or not, the first time I'd beheld it, a trembling naked slave thrown over the horse of the captain of the guard. It had been the custom in those days to strip slaves well before their arrival in Queen Eleanor's realm. She wanted her peasants and villagers to enjoy the spectacle of new arrivals, and I had walked a good deal of the way here, though the captain, tiring of the slow pace, had thrown me over his horse for the final mile. I'd been so fearful, so defenseless, so certain that I could never endure the things my older brother had so vaguely yet impishly described. "You'll do well, Dmitri," he'd said, "just as I did. Simply yield and obey." He had laughed. "Let me assure you, you'll know more good hot pleasure there than you'll ever know anywhere afterwards." Within 6 months, the Queen had had enough of my clumsiness and uncontrollable tears and packed me off to the village for punishment. I'd wondered whether or not my disgrace was known to my family back home. In fact, it had never been communicated to them, and they were never told that I'd been later kidnapped and taken to the Sultanate, where I served for so long. I stood staring at the great doors before me, remembering how I had scarcely dared to look up on that first day. The captain had smacked me hard with his leather belt, telling me to stand straight and bow my head, and take pride that I was about to serve the great queen. He'd snapped his fingers for two of his soldiers, directing them towards me with silent gestures that I hadn't understood. In a moment, I understood all. They had stroked and teased my balls and cock until I was hard from it, pinching my nipples and spanking me with their hard, calloused hands until I'd been presentable, as they called it, and I'd been so confused by the intense desire I'd felt. "The Queen will love you," the captain had said, with a wink, as he rode off. When I'd seen him next, 6 months later in the Queen's village, he'd whipped me with his strap for what seemed an eternity, chiding me for having failed at court, and promising me the place of public punishment would make me into a perfect prince for the queen. That had been before I was auctioned in the village square, and sold to one of the retired soldiers who kept a house on the outskirts of the little place. "You let me take him right to the place of public punishment," the captain had told my new owner. "Let them have him for 2 or 3 days and nights there, to curb all this trembling and weeping. Look at that dancing cock. He wants to please. Trust me, I know how to handle this one. Truly, I do." And so my new master had agreed. I was never to know him or meet him. The Sultan's men snatched me up from one of the many public pillories in the place of public punishment within a couple of nights. But the captain's prediction had proved true. I had already learned a great deal there. A great deal. And as I walked slowly into the inner courtyard, it was that place, the place of punishment in the Queen's village, that I thought of, among other memories of the village, as I had known it during my last year in the realm. Then I woke to the inner courtyard and stood stock still, amazed. No horses or beasts were allowed this far, plainly, and the flat stone pavers were polished like glass. Great garlands of greenery and bright flowers decorated the lower portion of the walls, and a forest of potted fruit trees lined the façade on either side of the great doors. Row after row of windows, rising on all sides, showed boxes of fresh flowers, and here and there a bit of curtain blowing in the breeze. Even high on the battlements I saw the luxuriant greenery, and the very stones themselves of every surface, both near and far, seemed smoothed and cleaned. Out of the castle came a gaggle of shining naked slaves, radiant men and women, to greet us, to offer wine to us if we were immediately thirsty from our journey, and to direct our servants where they might take their master's parcels and trunks. Ah, such a magnificent sight. How long had it been? Too long. I could tell Fabian was dazed as well, but not so dazed that he had not recovered the 2 caskets for me that contained my special gifts for the new king and queen. It is tiresome to speak of women's breasts like melons, but that is precisely what I thought as the young nymphs approached us. Their breasts are like melons, so lush and so soft. And yes, I took the goblet of cool, sweetened and watered wine gratefully, and drank it down in one gulp. The slaves beamed at us, glancing up shyly as they surrounded us. "The king is coming to greet you, Prince Dimitri," said one remarkable vision of splendid black curling tresses and dark red nipples and glossy, curly, pubic hair. Her eyes were brimming with modest spirit. I'd always found this type of slave irresistible. I wanted to reach out and touch this pubic hair, but it did not seem polite to do such a thing until I'd been received. Any master or mistress of the kingdom could handle or examine any slave, but I was not yet part of the kingdom. A tall, naked young man with a cherub's mop of blonde curls offered to take the precious caskets from Fabian, but I shook my head, no. Fabian was devouring the stripling with his eyes. He couldn't help himself, and as the naked slaves surrounded us, Fabian seemed almost fearful, as though they were exotic beasts. The little band urged us towards the open doors. It was all I could do not to squeeze the little bottom swaying before me, the high muscular backside of the boy, or the soft swelling bottom of the succulent little girl. Now, I should say that none of these slaves were as young as we had been when we were sent here, and I knew from the many proclamations made by Beauty and Laurent that only those old enough to consent resolutely to their servitude were now accepted. But still, these young men and women did seem to me in their freshness to be girls and boys. Suddenly, 3 familiar figures appeared in the great door at once. My beloved Princess Rosalind and darling Princess Elena and His Majesty, King Laurent. The king opened his arms as we walked towards each other. I was in tears. Grand and handsome as I remembered, taller than any man I knew, and graced surely with one of the most appealing of beautiful faces I'd ever seen, Laurent smiled warmly as we came into each other's embrace. "Beloved Dimitri, friend from the Sultanate, how marvelous it is to see you." He looked so earnest and so cheerful. "Your Majesty." I bowed from the waist, but he bid me rise at once, and kissed me on the right and left cheeks. Don't stand on ceremony here, Dmitri. You come in and let us take you to the quarters waiting for you.
Yes, I've been seeing to your chambers all day, said Rosalind, as buxom and rosy-cheeked as she had ever been,
her dark hair daintily coiffed, her familiar voice bringing delicious chills to all my skin.
We'll take you up into the northeast tower, coolest of the towers. Everything's ready for you. Beloved, we're so glad you've come,
Princess Elena confided as she took my arm. If anything, she was more beautiful. I could scarcely believe my eyes.
Tonight at supper, our king will introduce you to all the court.
We were proceeding now into the great entrance hall. Everywhere I looked, I saw naked slaves with luxuriant, well-groomed hair, walking here and there with their heads bowed, and some positioned, as in the old days, along the walls, legs wide apart, heads bowed, hands behind their necks. Why, there wasn't a space of bare wall in the entire immense hall. Beside me, a gorgeous young satyr waited to take my gloves as I drew them off my hands. Doorways in every direction were flanked by naked slaves. Even hugging my two beautiful companions warmly, and excited by Laurent's hand on my shoulder, I still felt the keen stab of memory of that long-ago day, when I'd been brought here barefoot before so many staring eyes. Why these thoughts, when the spectacle was so dazzling? Had the old regime ever had such an abundance of delectable flesh? Flashes of the place of public punishment returned. How is one to ask about such a place when one is being received at court with such generosity? And yet it was all I could think of, suddenly. The public turntable, being brought up the ladder to it, and told to kneel over with my chin on the thick, square wood post. The crowd had been hooting and cheering. I'd panicked, as always, and within seconds my hands had been placed in the small of my back, my wrists bound tight. The leather straps had gone over my calves, binding me to the floor of the turntable, and the whipping master was laughing as he lifted the big wooden paddle in front of my face, so I would see it.
What do you think, young prince?
He'd roared for the benefit of the raucous crowd.
Is this fine enough for a spoilt little brat boy from the castle who spilled the queen's wine and tried her patience?
Laurent was leading me himself into one of the many parlors off the entrance hall, and I saw before me the lovely figure of Queen Beauty seated there in a high-backed chair. There was a table piled with fancy cakes and silver goblets. Naked slaves stood ready with silver pitchers, and trays of steaming hot dainties. The scent of cinnamon and fresh roasted apples filled the air.
Come and sit here with me, dearest prince, said the queen,
as I bowed and rose slowly to kiss her outstretched hand. Rosalind and Elena stood beside her, beaming at me. Fabian stood far back against the wall, anxious yet excited, clutching the caskets to his chest. I could see the slaves smiling secretively to one another as they enjoyed his discomfort. He was red-faced. Well, it had been a long time since the faraway land of Lexius's home across the seas.
Your Majesties, I have gifts for you, I said.
My voice sounded strained and raw, but I was seated now and the wine was welcome. Yes, cool, sweet wine. The young boy who poured it seemed as tentative and uncertain of himself as I did, not daring to steal the smallest glance at me, his hard chest well polished and buffed to a sheen. His nails were trimmed in gold.
At court this evening, of course, Prince, you are most gracious, said the lovely queen. Don't bother with such things now. We are grateful for your presence here under our roof. And your man there, let him take your things to your chambers.
Such blue eyes. Of course I had blue eyes, and so did my lovely Rosalind and Elena, but the queen's were deeply blue, and so big. Princess Rosalind was already leading Fabian away. I nodded to reassure him.
Yes, we'll see to your room. Make certain all is perfect, said Elena, who hurried after them.
Well, I would have known you anywhere, said the king, seating himself near the hearth on the far right. That black hair, thick and shining as ever, and your face, it's hardly changed at all.
A boy I hadn't seen before, a boy of incomparable dark brown skin and long black hair, filled the king's goblet. The boy had gold earrings in his ears, and lashes so thick they cast a faint shadow on his smooth high cheeks. I stared at his pinkish cock, marveling at the color of it, the dark brown and pinkish tints blended into it, and such a nest of hair, curling hair. When he turned and put the pitcher on the sideboard, I couldn't keep my eyes from his backside, wanting to see the pink anus between those firm buttocks. Yes. Somehow I managed to speak.
"You're kind, sire,"
I said. "I wish I were a bard that I could sing of what I see when I look at you and your queen. Again, I'm so happy to be here at last, to be back in Bella Vulton. I am so happy to be received." And again, in a jarring flash, I was on the turntable of the place of public punishment, and that wooden paddle came slamming down on my bottom, and I heard the excited roar of the crowd. I tried to clear my vision, to hear what the queen was saying, that they were so glad to receive me. I wanted to put my heated, tumbling thoughts in order. Why, after all, when I'd been whipped there so often after my return from the Sultanate, did my mind go back, right back, to that very first terrifying time?
"It will purify you,"
the captain had said earnestly, almost tenderly, as I was forced up the ladder.
"Believe me, it is the most effective punishment. That's why I want you to receive it now and often. You'll see. Now up you go."
I felt the whipping master's left hand on my neck. Always. Left hand on the neck. My chin rested on the rough wood, and the crack over and over of the paddle, and the crowd screaming.
"Little piglet," said the whipping master, "you're giving the crowd a great show. You just keep struggling with all your might against those straps. But keep your chin on this post, or I'll let the crowd name the number of the blows."
Struggling. I felt it again, my toes hammering down on the wood, my thighs tensing, and my hands twisting and turning in the ropes. But the heavy hand on my neck kept my head firmly in place, my chin on the rough wooden post. And through my tears I saw the crowd in a haze before me, all around me, cheering and waving, and one lovely girl with a bright round face smiling at me as she waved a blue scarf. Strange to remember such a detail, but then after... Yes, that scarf. With a sudden shock, I realized the captain, the very captain who had taken me that day to the public turntable, was standing here beside the queen.
"Prince Dimitri, of course you remember Captain Gorton,"
she was saying in her sweet, cordial voice. I couldn't speak.
"Prince, you said in one of your letters you were eager to see the village,"
the king said casually.
"Well, the captain will escort you there whenever and however often you want to see it. Why, there's plenty of time before supper, if you're so inclined."
"Our guest might want to rest, my lord," said the queen. "He has a world of time in which to see everything."
"The village? Any time?" "Yes, of course," said the king. "But I welcome Dimitri's estimation of the village. I really do. I'm pleased that Dimitri has asked about it, mentioned it." "Yes, your majesty," said the captain.
"I do so want to see it," I said, trying to steady my voice.
"But you're white, prince, perfectly white with exhaustion," said the queen. "You should sleep first."
"I am yours, my lord," said the captain to me. "All afternoon, I'm at your service."
It was this man, this very man who stood at my service now, waiting, silent, waiting, who had brought me down the ladder and pushed me roughly towards the pillory, lifting the board and forcing my hands and my head through the holes and then slapping the board down in place. The board had held me bent over from the waist, my bare feet in the dust. I could barely look up, but I did, and I saw the next victim on the distant turntable, a dainty, red-haired princess blushing and gasping as the whipping master forced her to kneel down and bend over and place her chin on that post, as he'd forced me to do. Her large, lovely eyes were suddenly squeezed shut. Then something blue filled my vision. Blue. It was that scarf. And a tender voice said in my ear,
"Let me wipe your tears. You are so handsome."
It was that round-faced girl from the crowd, with skin like fresh cream.
"There, there,"
she cooed.
and another pair of hands appeared cupping a crude bowl of wine, and I saw fingers dipped in it, and I was given the fingers, dripping with wine, to suck.
You know, Dmitri, we lack a guiding genius for the place of public punishment, the king said. Perhaps for many aspects of the village. You mentioned that place in your letter. I never really knew the place. The words struck my heart. A guiding genius. It's going well, sire, said the captain.
Yes, captain, I know, said the king, and the lady mayor has the whole enterprise in hand. But it's huge now, and the opinions of our beloved returning princes and princesses provide much insight.
I saw the blue scarf in front of my eyes, heard the sounds of the crowd, and it had only been the morning crowd. The captain had been scolding the villagers behind me as I lapped the wine from the girl's cupped hand.
That's it, dearest prince, she whispered. I was so thirsty.
My tongue scraped the palm of her hand.
No touching him there, said the captain to the others, whom I couldn't see. You may pinch and prod, but cocks starve in the place of public punishment.
It had been so warm there, and so dusty.
Yes, with feathers you can tease him, that's fine, or whisk brooms. But that cock is to starve, and you know this.
The captain's belt struck my backside, struck the flesh that was so sore and hot from the turntable. I knew it was the captain.
Now you're going to spend the day here, little boy, he had said. You'll be spanked again up there at noon and again at dusk. And by late evening, when you're brought up there for the last time, I want to see some composure. You understand me? I want to see an end to all that struggling. You're here to learn to be the perfect little boy the queen desires.
Crack of the strap.
Prince, I think you should rest now,
said the lovely new queen, leaning towards me.
You are pale and trembling. I think you're right, I said.
It was more of a stammer, a murmur.
And then, later,
composure. Well, I'd learned composure. But it was not there, not on that day, not with this man schooling me, though he had certainly given it his best. I'd learned it in the distant land of the Sultan, one of the last slaves privileged to know that strange exotic paradise before Lexius had come to warn all of its doom.
2. My chambers were lavishly furnished. Two naked slaves were in attendance, and my befuddled servants and grooms were hustled off to a servant's wing to be fed and rested. Fabian remained, of course, with a bed in an ample closet adjacent to my bedchamber. The cold stone walls had been panelled in finely polished dark wood, and draped here and there with heavily embroidered hangings, and even the floors, which had always been damp in my time, were covered by scattered exotic carpets. The bed was quite impressive, draped in linen as well as richly dyed wool, and the writing table and chairs were exquisitely carved, with the usual curlicues and tiny animals. Indeed, there were more wood movables in the room than I'd ever seen. Stools, tables, cushioned benches, whatever one might desire for sitting, or a goblet, or a foot. And even the great fireplace itself had a coat of arms carved in the stone chimney-piece, though whose coat of arms it was I didn't know. The fire chased the damp, and the air outside was deliciously mild as it always was in Bellavolton. Perhaps the ancestors of the old queen would have never attempted naked pleasure slavery had not the kingdom existed in this sheltered valley, subject to warm breezes and a break in the mists that so often hover over coastlands. I lay down on the bed and fell into a dead sleep for 2 hours. It was only early afternoon when I waked, sat up, and looked about myself. The two slaves knelt by the fireplace, facing me, sitting back on their heels, their heads bowed. Immediately one rose, the girl slave, a beauty, as were they all, but this one particularly was fair, with the loveliest thick braids of blonde hair and playful waves about her high, smooth forehead. She came at once to the side of the bed with a goblet for me and a little plate of sliced apples.
Master, what can I get for you?
Tell me if all the chambers in this new wing are so lavishly appointed, I asked. I devoured the apple hungrily. It was all the food I wanted just now. I drank the cool water.
Yes, Master, she said, Throughout the castle, all the rooms have been restored. Merchants came day after day for months from Italy, Spain, and lands to the east with cartloads of tapestries and carpets for the refurnishing of the castle. Carts laden with beds and furnishings arrived every morning for so long, and even now the carpenters are at work in the Queen's village, though now it's called the Royal Village. She had pretty eyes and plump cheeks, though her chin was small and delicate. Her breasts appeared slightly moist, dewy, and this time I didn't resist the urge to slip my hand between her legs, to feel the soft, warm pubic hair and the lips, so naked, so tender. She held quite still as I did this, the goblet and plate in her hand, not daring to move. "And have you been here since the king and queen came?" I asked.
"I've been here for 2 years, master," she said. "I was sent from a homeland that is gone now. I am at home, here, with the king's blessing."
Just the faintest blush flared in her white cheeks. I examined her nipples idly, pinching them to make them nice and hard. How many times had that been done to me? How many times a day? I felt the old hands polishing my balls and cock with oil, oiling my anus, the old idle spanks, the pinching of my thighs. She was incomparably lovely, but then so were they all. "And your name, precious?" I asked.
"It is Kira, master.
That's the new name that the king gave me when I was anointed in the Goddess Grove." "Anointed? What in the world are you talking about?" I probed. I took the goblet again and drank the rest of the water.
"My lord, that is how it is done now with our new slaves. And of course, those of us who had been here before had to renew our vow. We are taken to the Goddess Grove at night, by torchlight, and there we are confirmed in our given names, or the new names we have chosen, and there we are received with kisses by King Laurent and Queen Beauty, and blessed for 2 years' service. Of course, the Nuons are on probation for 6 months, but we are not, as we are well-trained already."
It was difficult for her to keep her eyes down. She stole a lightning glance at me as she spoke. "You may look at me, Kira," I said, "though you must do it respectfully."
"Yes, my lord," she said.
I looked at the boy slave who knelt as before, waiting, it seemed, for my permission to rise. "And your brother slave there?" I asked. "His name? Come here, young man."
"Bertram is his name, my lord," said Kira.
Bertram rose at once and came to the girl's side. He was tall, very fair-skinned, with almost white hair, tousled and thick, yet trimmed just below his ears to unruly waves. Clearly he'd been sleeping as he knelt by the fire, and his big grey eyes were dreamy. His cock was coming awake. Motioning for the girl to move back, I beckoned for him to come forward. Quite a cock. Not just long, but thick. "And you, Bertram?" I asked. "Have you been here long?"
"I was received a month ago, sire," he said.
His voice was quaking. Indeed, I could see now that he was very anxious. The muscles of his belly were tightening. He had good, powerful arms and elegant hands that hung at his sides. The curling hair around his cock was dark, the color of ash or smoke, as so often happens with blonde-haired boys. "And anointed in the grove?" I asked.
"Yes, sir. And I will be confirmed in 5 months, if I please, my lord, and I hope to please you."
He was as modest as the girl, gazing downward. His cock was now hard as a branch.
"Of course you do," I said.
"And are you of royal birth?"
"No, my lord."
He blushed.
"I was a clerk, a scribe. I heard of the new kingdom and came as quickly as I could."
"Go on," I said. I took another slice of the apple and munched on it.
"I rode night and day, my lord," he said. "I walked the last 2 days as I sold my mount for the last part of the journey. I wanted so to serve. I was accepted at once, and I'm grateful for that."
Impressive, I said. "You're as handsome as any prince I ever knew here. How many other magnificent flowers are there, beyond these walls, out there in the world, as fragrant and beautiful as the royal blooms that once adorned these halls? Turn around, both of you." How many times had I been ordered to do that?
and to stand silent for inspection of the most intimate sort. My cock was getting hard looking at them, at their firm bottoms and straight backs, at their silky skin. The boy's bottom was lean, and I could see his pink little anus plainly enough, and his heavy balls. Very inviting. But I wanted to go outdoors. I wanted to see the village. I wanted to use the daylight hours while they lasted. Very well, both of you. Turn back around. Fabian had wakened in his closet and come into the room, fully dressed as before, and he was holding my belt and tunic. Now, are you assigned to me, children? I asked. Or do you belong to this chamber, or the hour of the day? I slipped off the bed and they stepped aside as Fabian put my tunic over my head and smoothed it down, while I put my arms through the sleeves.
We are yours, my lord, chosen for you by Prince Alexei and King Laurent, who hoped we would be pleasing to you, and will only retire when you dismiss us, at which time other slaves shall come, also chosen.
Ah, the kingdom is rich, I said.
I took the girl's face in my hands and kissed her on the lips. She smelled of flowers and fresh air, and her little mouth quivered and stiffened against my lips. It seemed a shock ran through her, and then it passed into me. I shifted uncomfortably and stood back for Fabian to buckle my belt. These were heavy Russian garments. I would change later to the lighter, shorter belted tunic and swap these trousers for leggings, but now it didn't matter. I took the boy's face and kissed him as well. He was my height, utterly passive. When I was new, I'd trembled or shaken every time I was touched or kissed, and the old queen had been furious. But this lad was perfect. And to think, if this boy does not please, he will not only be whipped for the next 6 months, harder and longer and more angrily than other slaves who do please, but sent away when the period of testing is over. Will he beg to remain? Will they make a groom of him, perhaps? I looked at both of them for a long moment. Fabian, go see if the captain of the guard is still prepared to take me down to the village. I eyed the boy and girl.
Yes, my lord, he is, and has come twice to ask after you, Fabian said. I'll go tell him that you're ready.
Bertram and Kira, I said, tell me, how many of Queen Eleanor's slaves left when allowed to do so? The new king and queen did allow them the choice, did they not?
Yes, my lord,
the girl answered. She was clearly the more confident, but the boy's voice was as cultured as hers.
They were allowed to make the choice. Two made the choice, but only when the king allowed that they might return at some point in the future.
Two? Out of the whole kingdom?
There were only a few hundred slaves, my lord,
Kira explained,
and most had been here a long time. The old queen, she was not.
I know. I've heard. She was tired. Indifferent. Very well, I understand.
Some of the great families, they insisted that they still be able to send their royal sons and daughters here,
Kira volunteered.
But the king and queen were resolute. All slaves must be of age to decide for themselves. And so these kingdoms have been choosing from willing subjects of all rank and sending new offerings.
I see. Well, I'm going out now. And you will remain here as you've no doubt been instructed.
Yes, my lord,
came from both of them, more or less at the same moment, and they stood back, the girl still holding the two shining silver implements, and the boy as submissive as before. Oh, the hours of boredom. How I remembered that, too, waiting, and the agony of my aching cock, and so longing for the slightest touch, even of the belt or the paddle, or fingers, living fingers. I went to the window and looked out. I was on the top floor here, some 5 stories above the ground. The window was a great open arch, and the air was filled with the scent of orange blossoms or something just as sweet. Below, I saw gardens sprawling in all directions, with trees and neatly trimmed shrubbery running in courses, and what seemed beaten pathways, though soft, dusty pathways, so silken to bare feet, that I remembered from the old days, and figures, well-attired figures moving all over, and slaves, slaves everywhere. Countless courts and squares were visible, and the sparkling dance of fountains. I could make out the vast central garden of old, surrounded by the bridle path, And indeed I realized that slaves were being spanked along the rectangular courses of the bridle path now by mounted figures. "Kira, why is the bridle path in use at this hour?" I asked, beckoning for the girl to come to me. In my time it was in the morning and the evening. She came up near silently beside me. Again, that whiff of sweet perfume.
"My lord, it is always busy now, the bridle path," she said,
"and the hunt in the maze, and so many other games. There is always feasting outdoors. There are so many guests, so many slaves."
"I see. And were you both paddled on the path this morning? I saw no evidence of that."
"We were pardoned to attend you, my lord," she explained. "We are yours for as long as you want us. We are fresh for you."
"Indeed you are," I said, kissing her again. "Now back to your places by the fireplace, both of you." They rushed to obey. Fabian had returned. He held the door open for me. 3. I had entered the great castle by its north gates, and the gardens I'd seen below lay to the east and the south, as far as I could figure, something perhaps that I'd never thought about in years past. And I was led out now through a western gate to a vast paved courtyard. There was a paved road leading out of it of the smoothest stones, and right before us stood a great gilded chariot of sorts, in which 3 or 4 men might stand, ample to hold me and Captain Gordon, and, wonder of wonders, my beloved Prince Alexei, who came to join us. But what astonished me more than anything, even more than the vibrant and welcoming smile on Alexei's face, was the great team of human ponies, outfitted and ready to pull the chariot. I was stunned, speechless at the sheer spectacle of it. I noticed the handsome grooms in their ornate blue and gold livery, with long flat straps in their hands or hooked to their belts, who stood back away from us and the team. There were 4 of them. Their clothes were richer than those of the servants I'd seen earlier at the castle, who wore the very same colors, but had no straps in hand or hanging from their belts. Alexei wrapped his arms around me and kissed me warmly. Ponies or no ponies, this was an exquisite moment.
"Dmitri, I'm so glad you're here," he said. "Ah, such a beautiful deep voice, and the same delicate dark skin. So very glad. You will allow me to go down to the village with you?"
"Oh,
most certainly," I said, holding him to my heart. "Alexei, you look as fit and happy as you were the day we rode out of here." Indeed he did. His auburn hair was long, curling and beautifully groomed, and his face was fresh and rested, and his dark eyes brilliantly clear. He was attired in burgundy velvet, a short tunic and leggings and boots, and he wore a great gold chain around his neck with a disc on it. There was writing on the disc. I knew there would be time for him to explain its significance to me.
"Come on, let's go. We can talk on the way," Alexei said. "You look positively dazed, my friend. This chariot was made specially by King Laurent in the fashion of olden times."
He gestured to it, and indeed it was grand.
"I believe it's called a quadriga."
The silent grooms were looking us over furtively, but their eyes were mainly fixed anxiously on the 16 ponies.
"Perhaps you'd like to see the ponies first, Prince,"
said the captain, but it was said in a cautious, respectful voice, and once again I heard the old voice behind it, the voice that had commanded me to the village stables when I'd returned from the Sultanate.
"The Queen wants all that exotic softness cleaned away,"
he'd said back then, so firm, so quick with the strap. I forced myself to look into his blue eyes. "Yes, I do want to see them," I said. He was still a striking man, not the youthful, golden god he'd seemed in those days, yet perhaps more powerful, more intriguing. My stomach felt weak, but the desire in me was rising, and when that happens, I feel nothing in my head or stomach. We walked slowly towards the team. It was 4 across and 4 rows in length, all strongly built men, gorgeous men, with muscles oiled and gleaming, clearly matched for beauty and size, all of the same impressive height, and even their luxuriant hair was trimmed identically at the back of the neck and combed back out of their faces.
"Ah, a chariot for a team of four across, and now I understood the word quadriga. Never in all my time in the village, pulling wagons or carts, or even the occasional fancy coach, had I ever seen a team of men of this size or so lavishly ornamented. I was utterly dazzled. I saw gold and scarlet everywhere I looked, and jewels sparkling in the afternoon sunlight. We'd been lowly beings, the work ponies of the village. These were ponies of a royal equipage. Maybe the pretty girls of the mayor's small stable had been so turned out, but never us, except in some meagre fashion on race days. Every male stood proud and tall, harnessed in bright gold and scarlet decorated leather, with gold blinders at the sides of his eyes, gold lacings covering his arms as they were folded behind his back, and a gleaming gold band around his forehead. Even the anal plugs were gold, with the long, thick horse's hair tail dyed red, and gold were the boots that ran halfway up the calf of each steed, with red jeweled buttons and loops. And added to that were bits of gold in each mouth, and the gilded reins that ran back to the chariot. Countless adornments enhanced the harnessing and straps everywhere that I looked, tiny gold bells dripping everywhere, and gold and jeweled buckles and rosettes decorating all connective links, and the straps that ran over the shoulders and down between the legs, anchoring the butt-plug horsetails and binding them to the tight lacings that bound the erect cocks and shining oiled scrotum of each pony. How I remembered the feel of all this, the delicious snugness. Even the hair of the ponies was dusted with gold, and their pubic hair as well. And the blinders, I saw now, were not solid gold at all, but stiff coverings of gold silk for the eyes, through which I could easily see the eyes staring forward, which meant that the ponies could see where they were going, and they could see me studying them, though they didn't dare to look at me. Only the four at the very head of the team lacked these blinders. As I stood before them, I felt my own cock stirring in my trousers, and I wondered if my face was visibly burning. I was grateful.